can see now that I've painted myself into a corner with the Series 3 podcast themes. I want to talk at length about the movies and books that the podcasts are based on, but since they're built around the chapter and verse quiz, this means I can't really mention the name of the book or movie until the following show. So get ready to hear a lot of beeping. This is not because I'm swearing. I'm taking out the titles of the books and movies. It just means there's going to be more clues. Even the album art should be a strong clue. The title of the show, Tenements, comes from the chapter and verse quiz we'll be describing later. The chapter scene takes place in a tenement setting. While I've been a perpetual tenant, I've been lucky enough never to live in a tenement. But if I stretch the definition beyond living quarters to include the space I work in, then I've spent some time in a few tenements. The definition of tenement today includes the ideas of overcrowding with an unsafe atmosphere. I've worked in jobs with unsafe atmospheres. You may remember my story about an overzealous blueprint machine that filled my office with ammonia. But there was a far more heinous job in my past that tried to kill me. This was way back in the days before personal computers, the Dark Ages, or the Dark Room Ages. Back then, if an image needed to be duplicated, enlarged, put through a filter, what have you, it was done photographically. I worked in three separate companies that had three different darkroom setups. The one I'll call a tenement had a darkroom so small it barely held the stack camera and the operator. I should explain that a stack camera was a large copy camera with a built-in lighting system. Stack cameras were usually vertical cameras with the lens pointing towards the floor and the film back flat like a tabletop. And the film back usually hovered about chest high but could raise and lower to focus. A typical stack camera used a copy platform with a built-in vacuum system. The vacuum held the material to be photographed flat. This tenement where I worked had a stack camera room which was entered through a large black tube with a revolving door. It was such a small space the camera operator needed to stand in this tube and reach through the door to use the camera. The tenement, like a real tenement, had no ventilation. The tenement was really an advertising agency on its last legs. It may never have been a great success as a business, but it was definitely in free fall when I walked in the door. The company began operating in Chicago, a real advertising super hub, but when I found it, it had moved to Rockville, Maryland. I never knew the complete history of the company, but later, as I was quitting, I found out that the owner had a problem with drugs, and his business was suffering along with his personal life. This tenement building was across the street from the Rockville Government Center, only two short blocks from the library. The tenement was on a shady, tree-lined lane and had a very impressive open front area. A good four-fifths of the total space was up front where the salesmen's desks were arranged. The back room art department was also impressive. One entered through a sunlit loft. The art department was on the other side of a partition that ran through the entire space. It occupied the remaining fifth, but was further divided into a large derelict photographic studio on the ground floor and a small, hectic graphic arts area with four workstations in the loft. Eventually, we artists found out that this tenement ad agency had a practice of working on spec. That is, we created whole campaigns that were speculative ventures. The art department would create concepts for the salespeople to take to clients, but the clients were only prospects. They never asked for the artwork, and they rarely, if ever, wanted to buy our services. The salesman would return and say that the client wasn't happy with the art. The sales team obviously also lied to us about deadlines. We worked overtime on presentations that were just a prop for an exposed salesperson to bolster their courage behind. They played us for suckers and ignored our complaints about the stat camera that was trying to kill us. The design of the art department loft was handled before I started work there. They installed the stat camera into an airless closet. I was familiar by this time with many types of stat cameras, but this one was different. Somehow this camera's lighting system burned oil. I don't know how or why. It might have been that the vacuum system used a hydraulic oil that leaked onto the lights. We could see the smoke coming from the lights. Unhealthy air slowly filled the closet while we worked. The best you could do was focus the camera quickly, get out of the closet while the exposure was happening. But still, you'd need to return and process the film or paper. I remember feeling the droplets form on my lungs. I had a constant cough, but I needed the job. In fact, when they could no longer pay us suckers, we walked away and the place was gone within a week. Part 2, The Summer Tenement. Before the ad agency, and before I started working in the world full-time, I toiled at another tenement. One summer, I was a day laborer on a construction site. We were building a handball court in State College, Pennsylvania. The walls were made of 12-inch cement blocks. If you describe a cement block, you might start by saying it's very heavy or hard. But what isn't commonly known is that they're also very sharp. The texture is quite coarse, with sharp little edges. I was tasked with moving the blocks to where the masons were building the walls. The blocks would tear through my gloves like industrial cheese graters. I went through about a pair and a half of gloves a day. Somewhere between glove changes, my hands would feel the sharp edge of a block. By the end of the summer, my hands were a mess of calluses. When the construction of the handball court tenement reached the second floor, I was shown how to use a new piece of equipment on the site. I fed a conveyor belt with the 12-inch blocks, which were then carried by the machine up to the second floor. The conveyor would be manned at each end. Another laborer at the top would unload. The device had a few quirks. First, it squeaked very loudly, as if it were on stage projecting its song to the back row. If you've ever heard the musical West Side Story, you might remember the song I Feel Pretty. That's what the block elevator sang. It squeaked in the exact same tone, intervals, and rhythm as the song. All day long it squeaked, I feel pretty, I feel pretty, I feel pretty and witty and gay. But it never continued on with the song past that. I think this is because it was just a squeak, an accidental sound rising from a motorized gear turning a chain that propelled metal shelves upward. Gravity caused the shelves to drag against the metal frame as they moved. That was the squeak. If it had two more shelves, it would have squeaked a different tune. The repertoire choice of the conveyor notwithstanding, it was not a pretty machine. It needed paint. The sharp blocks and indifferent treatment by day laborers had scarred the machine's surface. But it was never designed to be stylish. It had ugly rubber tires sticking out. It had a big, ugly motor strapped to one side. It was plugged in with an extension cord that snaked through the job site. The squeak was hard to deal with. It was loud enough to make me want to plug my ears, and it was continuous. Maddening. This alone, however, didn't make the handball court a tenement. It was the final quirk of the conveyor belt. Some dewy mornings or days after a rain, the block elevator gave out a shock when the block was in contact with both the elevator and the laborer. There must have been an electric short somewhere, and the machine wasn't grounded. The extra electricity in the frame traveled through the block straight into me. The only way to avoid a shock was to drop a block a few inches above the conveyor belt. And this isn't as easy as it sounds. It's natural to set something heavy down and push off as you straighten up.
Holding a block over the target takes more strength
then swinging a block up onto the belt and controlling its fall until it lands. This is something you learn after being shocked over and over. The wages for this job barely covered my gloves, with food and rent subtracted, so it didn't occur to me to show up to work with a grease gun to end the squeaks, or a roll of electric tape, a ground wire, and possibly a rubber mat, something to prevent the shock treatments. These two true stories from my past just go to prove the epigram, first coined by Friedrich Nietzsche: what doesn't kill us makes us have a chronic respiratory condition and a twitch. I look forward to the next Rotcast, where I will take the opposite tack and talk about living in palatial mansions and country estates. We call that show House Nice.
Up next, the juicy truth.
This is the first juicy truth I've done exclusively with number one, and I think you'll hear that she doesn't feel too confident, maybe, about speaking of wine, although she has been with us on several other occasions. You'll hear her answer sometimes a little too quickly, agreeing, getting it all out of the way.
Right.
To be honest, there wasn't a lot to say about this wine, and so I'm condensing our entire taping down to the essence. I'm here with number one, and you will remember her from famous podcasts like Mothers, and what, do you remember the last one you were on?
No.
If you could see this label and describe it, it's Francis Ford Coppola's Director's Cut series of wines from the Russian River Valley in Sonoma, California.
Okay, it looks like a whole lot of little girl dancers jumping rope with full skirts, and it's going around the bottle, and it looks like if you spun it fast enough that you would see the rope move. So why did you connect this wine with...
This wine label is designed after a zoetrope, a toy that gives movement to animated drawings. The movie and the book we will be describing in the chapter and verse quiz has a character who lifts himself and his daughter out of poverty by creating a similar toy. He sells flip books. This is why Francis Ford Coppola's Director's Cut Chardonnay is the perfect match for the film. The paper label is a white strip that winds around the bottle. Printed on the label in thick black ink are a series of silhouette drawings. The drawings show a young girl in a full skirt and flat wide brim hat. Her hair is in long curls, and the drawing shows her in various attitudes or gestures as she jumps rope. I'll read part of the label. This graphic band is a replica of a 19th century original used in a device called a zoetrope. Zo, life, trope, movement, which produced the illusion of moving pictures from static ones. Chardonnay is a white grape with a neutral flavor. Chardonnay is widely planted around the world. Its flavor after fermentation comes partly from the place it's grown, but also from whether it's fermented in oak and what kind of oak. It can be styled as a crisp Chablis or conversely with more tropical fruit flavors. Since we haven't discussed Chablis, this means very little at this point, but you get the idea that a Chablis style of Chardonnay is going to be less pineapple and more green apple. Winemakers might choose to use oak both as an additive in the fermentation or in the barrel used to store the wine before bottling. The oak can add various flavors to the grapes. This is sometimes known as toastiness because the wooden staves of the barrel are lightly burned on the inside surface. One flavor associated with this process is vanilla. There are strong opinions about which style suits Chardonnay best. This wine did very well in the color, clarity, taste, acidity, alcohol balance, and body categories, but fared very poorly in aroma, complexity, and price.
It's just a very pale yellow.
I'll give it a 10. I have no problem with the color.
I think if it were green, I wouldn't want to drink it. Unless it were minty.
It's interesting you mention mint, because mint and flint are two flavor notes that are sometimes associated with Chardonnay.
Looks perfectly clear.
It's another 10. To smell it, you're supposed to stick your nose pretty far into the glass.
I don't smell much at all.
It's fairly faint.
What should it smell like?
Vanilla.
I don't smell any vanilla at all. Vanilla smells delicious. 4?
I'll go with a 4. I do taste some sweetness there. It's kind of almost like a honey, but very, very subtle honey that's kind of, the sweetness goes away really fast. Now, what they claim it should taste like, flavor of apples, peaches, pineapple, hints of lemon, and a round vanilla finish. I might be tasting what they're calling the vanilla finish as that honeyish flavor, but I guess of those fruits that they've named, the closest I would think...
I'll go with apple. Apple. I don't taste any pineapple.
So I have to agree with you. It's more apple-y.
7.
I'll go with an 8, and I guess we'll throw this to the judge.
I don't like it. Number 11 does not like it, so she's going to say 7.
Okay, 7 it is. Going back to the body, I would think this is a medium body. Medium to light. And so I think that's probably good for a white wine, and I'll give it a 9. Well, I know this was aged in new oak, but I don't think that's adding too much to the flavor. That, if we tasted a lot of vanilla, then I would think that would come from the oak. And since this is, it's aged for 10 years, in half the time it's in new oak and half the time is in older established oak. Since we're talking about white wine, there aren't any tannins to evaluate, and so that isn't going to help us talk about the structure. I'm finding it's very hard to say anything about the complexity. Another 4.
I don't think it's very high acidity, because I wouldn't like that.
We learned about number one's limited appreciation of wine acid during the volcano episode. And we had one from Thera, or Santorini. You really hated that wine. It had a lot of acid in it, right?
Okay, and this one doesn't.
No, I don't think so. But it should also be crisp.
No, it wasn't flat.
No, it wasn't flat. It's got a little bit of crispness to it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go as high as a 10?
Or 9, maybe.
Okay. Alcohol balance, it's fine. I don't taste any extra alcohol.
I agree.
Let's give it another 9 or 10.
That sounds good.
9.
What was the price for a bottle of this Francis Ford Coppola's Director's Cut Chardonnay?
The price of the bottle is $18.79.
I don't think I'd buy this bland wine again. It does make me curious, though, about Coppola's un-oaked wine. I would presume that wine has even less going on. No oak means they are removing a flavoring agent, and their oaked wine was too subtle for my palate. Now let's tabulate the score.
74, wow. It adds up to this, that this is a drinkable wine, but it's very bland, and it costs way too much.
So, I know you just saw Hugo not too long ago, and that was supposed to do with film. Would that fit with this wine also?
The mystery film and book we're hinting at also touches on early filmmaking in the U.S., but it's mostly an addition to the movie script. The novel originally presents the idea of a silhouette artist producing a flip book that eventually becomes a mass-marketed toy. So the wine label relates more to the mystery movie and only vaguely to Hugo. So the story contained within Hugo was close on the heels of American movie making. In Hugo, they show some of Edison's early motion pictures. They show George Millet watching some other movie before he decided to build his own camera. They show the connection between magicians, stage magicians, and movies.
How about Houdini? He was a magician. And was he interested in it?
Houdini, yes. Houdini was interested in film. In the early 1920s, he even started his own movie company and starred in many films. He gave it up, though, because there wasn't enough money in it for him. His earliest films were mainly a record of his outdoor escapes and some stage tricks. I'm glad you mentioned Houdini. That would be another good hint about the movie and the book we are trying not to name. There's a brief appearance by Harry Houdini. He's in the book more than the movie, but he's definitely in both. So that's your juicy truth for this episode. Again, the final score for Francis Ford Coppola's Russian River Valley Chardonnay Director's Cut 2010 was a low 74 points. Hey, number nine, do you own a mammoth fur bikini?
Why, yes I do, but it's at the cleaners. I doubt it would fit you, though.
Let's see, I've got my stone spears, dinosaur repellent, pterodactyl net.
Why are you packing all that weird stuff?
Oh, I'm getting ready for the monster bash.
You mean the one Creepy Classics and Scary Monsters is holding?
Is there another one? I'm going to Butler, PA, and I'm going to be prepared. Elephant gun?
I think you're over-preparing. It isn't until June.
Yeah, June 22nd through 24th, but I've never... It's getting closer.
Where did that come from? Don't move. It can't see you if you don't move.
Are you serious? It's looking right at me.
Yeah, trust me. It can't see you if you remain completely motionless. I saw that in a movie.
You mean a movie like the ones they show at the International Classic Monster Film Festival and Expo? I can't. I've got a...
Ooh, I told him not to move. The Monster Bash is June 22nd through 24th. You can register online at www.creepyclassics.com or call 724-238-4317. I've got my stone spears, my pterodactyl net, elephant gun. What else do I need?
Hi, this is Ron Adams. I am the program director, mastermind, mad doctor of Monster Bash, the conference in Pittsburgh, and you're listening to Rotcast, the sound of V-nostalgia.
Can you remember this clip from last episode's chapter and verse movie quiz? Listen.
So what do I got? I got some kind of religious loony for a client. I gotta find Johnny Golden Tonsils. We don't know where he is. He probably doesn't know who he is. I got a geriatric band leader in a home in Harlem. I got a guitar player called Toot Sweet. What else I got?
A hard-on?
The answer to the chapter and verse for episode 20 is Angel Heart. It was directed by Alan Parker and starred Mickey Rourke, Robert De Niro, and Lisa Bonet. It's been described as Raymond Chandler meets The Exorcist. I believe the egg-eating scene, which I described last episode, took the place of a section of the book in which Harry Angel follows Louis Cipher to a Skid Row magic show. De Niro is used in more scenes in the movie than the character Louis Cipher is presented in the book. The magic show Cipher puts on for the bums in New York wouldn't have been difficult to film, but I like the substitution of the egg scene. There's the same emphasis on the human soul, but the added symbolism in the movie is a lot of fun. The author, William Yortzberg, wrote the novel Falling Angel, which Angel Heart, the movie, is based on. I rarely read, and I never read a novel when I can watch the movie version, but this time I did both. The reason I did was because I discovered that Yortzberg wrote another book that I happened to read once, called Nevermore, and that made me curious. I enjoyed the novel Falling Angel just as much as the movie. Yortzberg likes to insert descriptions of New York into his narrative. In both Falling Angel and Nevermore, the city's architecture and city planning are important scenic backdrops. The director of Angel Heart, Alan Parker, wrote the screenplay and changed a few things. He set the movie down south near New Orleans. I think this is acceptable. It makes the geography of evil larger, extending it beyond New York. In the book, we get that same idea from stories one character tells another about travels in his youth. Parker also added atmospheric nightmares. The repeated depiction of confusing voodoo rites and dreams sets up a rhythm. When we return to rooms that Detective Harry Angel has already visited, we have a false sense of familiarity. It's more shocking then to see the bloody changes in some of these rooms. I don't want to spoil the film or the book. You can enjoy the film for its mystery aspect only once. But I find that symbolism can make a movie rewatchable. Joe vs. the Volcano, a movie we've already discussed, is a good example of this. I mentioned the symbolism inserted into the Angel Heart screenplay. There are two repeated images. One is of a cage-type elevator, always descending. The other is more subtle. In many scenes, there's a slowly turning fan. I think both of these are symbolic. The elevator is symbolic of going to hell. It's a dark and shadowy ride and always one way. When I tell you there are many oscillating fans in the movie Angel Heart, you might just think, well, it's hot down south. That's nothing special. But if you watch Angel Heart with both eyes, the director is trying to say something with the fans. They're turning so you can see the blades. This means they're turning too slowly to keep the air cool. And it's not just one of the fans turning slowly, they all are. Even the ones in cold New York. I believe the symbolism is the action of the revolving more than the fan. As one blade chases another forever, an eternal chase, like the one the devil is on for your soul. Finally, there is the egg-eating scene. Louis Cipher tells Harry of the symbolism of the egg and the soul as he eats a hard-boiled egg, remember? But what isn't said is Harry is a hard-boiled private eye. Like the egg, there is an inside to Harry. Louis slowly peels the egg. The action is menacing and well-practiced by Cipher. These ideas were not in the book. that keep the film interesting even after you know the ending of the movie. I have to smile at one other scene in Angel Heart. Exposition or information dumps in a movie can often threaten the flow of a narrative when one character is saddled with explaining everything. There's a scene in this movie where a female reporter gives Harry a whole bunch of information. But the director has covered the problem by having the woman do this while she's making out with Harry. It's a sex scene and an info dump. This movie was rated R for sex and bloody violence. This is Escorting Evelyn, the chapter and verse quiz for episode 21. It's 4 minutes long, and your clues are these. This scene has something to do with tenements, or tenement living, and this movie was based on a book. Here we go. A well-dressed young lady steps down from a coach into a busy street. She's in her 20s, but she's carrying a new dolly. She's dressed something like a doll herself. Her clothes are frilly and from an age gone by. There is a bow on her wide-brimmed hat. About her shoulders is a collar of lace that fans out like a small shawl. Her skirt is close at the waist, and so long it nearly sweeps the ground. She's carrying a drawstring purse that hangs from her wrist. She's a Charles Dana Gibson drawing come to life, a Gibson girl. A horse cart wheels by, driven by a man in overalls. It's followed by another, then another. The street is alive with activity. The sidewalks are also full. People are loafing on the curb or standing on stoop steps. Push carts are parked up and down either side of the street. The young lady's name is Evelyn, and she walks between horse carts over to where two short women are stationed at a makeshift table. The short lady's clothes look dingy compared to Evelyn's. They wear only simple scarves covering their heads. On their table rest two or three cabbage heads. Evelyn asks where she can find a man she saw in this spot the day before. It isn't clear her words are being understood, but the small ladies point to the other side of the street. Evelyn thanks them and heads back across the street behind the vehicle she arrived in. On the soundtrack, we hear a funny horn, a wooga. A man dressed in a chauffeur uniform with cap and gloves leans out the side of the large open car and explains to Evelyn that he can't wait in the road. She dismisses him and tells him to come back later. There's a jump cut. Three men stand with their backs to the camera. The central figure quickly sidesteps to the left to reveal a young man in the background. The young man wears a boater hat and a bow tie. A boater was a flat-topped straw hat with a wide brim. It was popular in the late 1800s as a men's casual hat worn in the summertime. Just as the lady's dress makes her stand out in the street, this man's hat marks him as venturing into a less affluent part of town. He stands for a moment staring. Then he turns in a sharp about face. He takes several steps away. There's another jump cut. We're now inside a dark hallway. We look towards the light of the door and we see Evelyn climbing the steps, the street behind her. A cut back outside shows the man in the boater cautiously following her up the steps. Inside again we see Evelyn climbing a dark staircase. The camera rises too as she passes by a window and turns down a hallway. She walks towards a door that is partly open. Again, Mr. Boater is seen on the staircase. He peers over the railing to watch Evelyn's direction. We see her at the end of the hall, open the apartment door, and pause to look into the room before she walks deeper in. She leaves the door open. Mr. Boater follows close behind. Now there is a different kind of edit in the scene. I'll call it an insert and a suture. The insert is a shot from above of an unmade brass bed. Lying scattered on the bed are paper clippings of different sizes. They are silhouettes, profiles of people cut from paper. They are slightly crumpled and left as refuse. Evelyn looks up. There is a bed in front of her. She then looks for a brief moment at the window next to the bed. She's in the slum tenement looking for someone who lived in this place. They were mad and they took everything but the silhouettes. They're not coming back and didn't leave any way for Evelyn to find them. The viewer gets a lot of information from this insert. The shot from above is Evelyn's point of view, but you can't see her and the condition of the bed in a single shot. The suture is our imagination tying together the insert and the shot of Evelyn standing at the side of the bed. She slowly turns halfway around and looks back towards the door. She screams. Mr. Bowder is standing inside the room and has startled her. We see her fall back on the bed and clutch the doll to her chest. Mr. Bowder holds out his lowered hands and steps towards her. She backs away in fright. The room is small and dingy. It's empty but for a few sticks of furniture. Evelyn backs towards a second window at the end of the bed. The man follows. She reaches behind herself as she backs away. Her hand finds a small but weighty oil lamp. She juggles the lamp clumsily, still holding the doll. Finally, she brandishes it as a weapon in front of her. She shifts her weight into a guarded stance. Evelyn says, "You stay away. Don't you come any closer." Mr. Bowder tries to reassure her. She drops her weapon slightly. He stiffly puts his hand into his jacket and removes a case from his pocket. He takes a business card from the small case and holds it out. He's nearly 10 feet away. He takes one large step forward. Evelyn raises her weapon again and points it at him. He takes a step back. They're both a bit ridiculous. Her with her doll and inadequate defense, and him with his funny straw hat and bow tie. He explains he won't hurt her. He says he's a businessman and reads a bit of his business card to her. He begs her to take the card and walks towards her. She slowly crosses the floor to meet him and rips the card from his hand. She retreats a bit and looks at the card front and back. She says, "What do you want?" with a little impatience. Mr. Bowder has explained a little of who he is and handed Evelyn his card, but he never speaks his name. He stammers, "I would very much like to escort you to something." Evelyn steps forward to return his card. He asks her to please keep the card. Then he says, "So what do you say?" and nervously clears his throat. Evelyn says,
"Are you some kind of a lunatic now?"
"I'm sorry, I'm acting like one, aren't I? You should see me at the office. I am really not like this. So what do you say? Do you have some free time?"
"Well, maybe."
Bowder takes her maybe as a yes. He's excited, and he asks when they might go out. Evelyn says, "What about right now?" Bowder is dumbfounded by her impulsiveness. He asks her to define what she means. He starts to say, "You mean just go?" Evelyn asks, "Is there anything wrong with right now?" He stammers a bit and finally states, "Right now is fine." Evelyn says with a giggle, "So, escort me to something." That was the chapter. Do you know this movie? Hear the answer in the next episode, episode 22.
Contentment costs less in a new brick home. Brick says clearly, here's genuine worth and the security that means contentment. When you choose brick, you gain leisure time and save maintenance dollars. Brick gives you lifelong freedom from upkeep bills. Because brick has permanent beauty in the richest, mellow colors and textures, your new home can be brick. Discuss it with your architect or express your wishes to the man who shows you a model home. They'll respect your knowledge that contentment costs less in a brick home. Structural Clay Products Institute, Department L, 1520, 18th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C.